Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. In the year 446, the inhabitants of Britain, beset on all sides by marauding barbarians, sent a pleading letter to the Roman general Aetius. Quote, "To Aetius, thrice consul, come the groans of the Britons. The barbarians drive us into the sea. The sea drives us back on the barbarians. Between them, two kinds of death face us. We are either slaughtered or drowned." The Irish came from across the sea to the west. The Picts came south through and around Hadrian's formerly great wall, and the Saxons came from the North Sea coast of the continent. They plundered and burned, pillaged and raped, killed and took captives. Without the Roman army to defend them, the Britons were helpless to beat back the attacks of these marauders. Within a generation, most of what remained of Roman Britain was lost and gone forever. In the first episode of this show, I emphasized the importance of taking a regional approach. The fall of the Roman Empire happened in much different ways in different places. Some regions barely experienced anything we would call a disruption until the year 500 or even later, while others were barely recognizable in comparison to their former selves by that date. No province of the former Western Roman Empire went down faster or harder than Britain, and no region was more fundamentally or more deeply transformed by the processes that we're calling the fall of the Roman Empire. The island fragmented politically into a patchwork of new kingdoms ruled by petty tyrants, some of them native, some of them foreign-born. The level of material sophistication dropped off drastically. By 500, nobody knew how to run a proper bathhouse, or, more seriously, even how to build in stone. The economy grew simpler, and barter replaced cash money. Urban centers shrank and all but disappeared. Roman law codes and legal concepts fell out of use. People stopped speaking Latin as an everyday language. Most strikingly, mass immigration from the northern part of the continent completely rewrote the political, linguistic, and demographic map of the island. Britain represents the catastrophe side of the fall of the Roman Empire. In almost no facet of life was there recognizable continuity between Roman Britain in the 4th century and Anglo-Saxon England in the 7th. So how did a prosperous Roman province, one that had been a fully integrated part of the empire for more than 300 years, longer than the United States has existed, become something so drastically different? How did the world of a cultured, town-dwelling, Latin-speaking populace become a world that could produce first the legend of King Arthur, and then become one that revolved around the mead hall of Beowulf? How, in other words, did Roman Britain become Anglo-Saxon England? That's what we'll explore in today's episode. Before we dig in, we need to talk a little bit about the evidence. This period and this region present some serious challenges to historians, especially those who rely on written texts. Why? Because we have almost no written texts to work with in Britain between 300 and 700. Our major textual narrator is the 8th century historian Bede, who provided that snippet of a letter that I quoted at the beginning of this episode. Bede was a great historian, one of the best of the Middle Ages or any era, who scrupulously recorded his sources, like that letter I quoted. But Bede was a monk who lived 300 years after the Britons sent that letter to Aetius, and his sources were limited. Moreover, he wasn't trying to tell the history of Britain. He was telling church history, and whatever else ended up in his narrative was incidental to that goal. No matter how good a historian Bede was, he couldn't tell us things he didn't know, and his perspective colors his treatment of what he did know. We also have a sermon written by a British monk named Gildas, entitled De Excidio et Conquestu Britanniae, on the destruction and conquest of Britain. As you'd expect with that title, it's a pretty gloomy text, and it focuses on the coming of the Saxons. Gildas lived closer to the end of Roman Britain than Bede, a couple of hundred years before him in the 6th century, but Gildas wasn't writing history, and he didn't scrupulously record his sources. He was writing polemic, a pointed argument about the failings of his fellow Britons in both his day and in the past. De Excidio was an exaggerated, angry writing by its very nature, and we forget that at our peril when we try to use it. Too many historians do forget that. That's about it in terms of written sources, and even the last century of Roman rule is pretty underreported. Imagine if all we had to talk about America from the founding of Jamestown in 1607 to the War of 1812 was a history a smart but reclusive guy without much to work with wrote in 2015, and then a sermon a firebrand preacher nutjob delivered in 1700, and you get a sense for how little material we have to understand this period. So if we don't have much in the way of text, what do we have to work with? How can we know anything if people weren't writing about it, or, if they were, if those writings haven't survived? Well, we have a lot of archaeology. Cemeteries and settlements from the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries have provided a great deal of useful information for us. So what kind of information does archaeology provide? Not narratives, at least not in the way that textual sources do. Instead, we learn about what kinds of houses people built. We learn about settlement patterns, how many people lived in what kinds of towns and villages. We learn about the material details of people's lives, what kinds of pottery they ate and drank with, what kinds of belt buckles they used. We learn about what kinds of coins they used to pay for things, or if they did at all. Through their bones, we learn about their lifestyles, what kind of work they did, what kind of food they ate, where they were born, and whether they had moved to get to where they died. Archaeology brings us closer to real people, to real lives, than textual material does. It's gritty, granular, and concrete. A window onto the lived reality of past human beings. We can look at their bones and see arthritis and healed injuries. We can use the isotopes in their tooth enamel to learn what kind of grain and seafood they ate. Through their genes, we can tell what color their hair or eyes were. To me, this is a much more desirable set of insights than one that focuses entirely on what some aristocrat or monk thought was happening. We've already used some archaeology in this show when we discussed the barbarian world beyond the empire's borders. We'll use it much more extensively here in this episode. This means that, of necessity, we'll be telling a different kind of story than we did in our discussion of the later Roman Empire or the Goths' journey from beyond the frontier to Rome. Different kinds of evidence allow you to talk about different things. Texts don't tell us about population health, settlement patterns, or even really migrations, but conversely, archaeological evidence doesn't generally tell us a whole lot about political organization or language. Where we have multiple kinds of evidence that speak to the same issue, they may not even tell the same story. Writers might talk about disaster and decline even while the archaeological evidence speaks to a flourishing economy. That was the case with much of the crisis of the 3rd century, as we discussed in the last episode. So our portrait of late Roman and post-Roman Britain is going to be based heavily on material remains and what we can interpret on that basis. So what is that story? Okay, well, before we get there, let's start with the Britain of the 4th century, so we know where we're beginning. Julius Caesar had led two expeditions to Britain in the waning days of the Republic, in 55 and 54 BC. By the time of Augustus's death in 14 AD, the island was increasingly integrated into the Roman world economically and even a bit culturally, though it remained politically separate. That changed 30 years later, in 44 AD, when the new emperor Claudius sent an army to conquer the island and formally annex it into the Roman Empire. This was an ongoing process that took a couple of decades, but by 80 AD, Britain was firmly under Rome's control. Despite Britain's distance from the imperial center, it was nonetheless thoroughly Roman, much more so than it had been in the 2nd and even the 3rd century. It was a thoroughly military province as well, and at its peak, an eighth of the entire Roman army would be stationed there. The Roman province had a population of something like 3.5 million people, possibly more, which was close to England's 14th century maximum on the eve of the Black Death, and about twice as many people as lived there in the 11th century. Britain was closely tied into the rest of the empire, especially to the provinces just across the English Channel. Links with the Rhineland, the frontier with the barbarian territories, were especially tight because they were both effectively military regions. Army units tended to travel from postings along Hadrian's Wall in the north to forts along the Rhine, and this meant a constant circulation of people, fashions, material goods, and ideas. By the 4th century, Britain had changed since the 2nd century, which, as we discussed in the last episode, represented the high point of empire. At that time, in the 2nd century, there was a stark contrast between the urban and the rural. The cities, places like London and York, were masterpieces of the Roman world. They were densely populated centers of manufacturing and trade, military bases and administrative centers, all packed with grand Roman-style baths and other monumental building complexes. They were little pieces of Rome plopped down in a mostly unintegrated countryside, where little had changed since before the Roman conquest. Peasant farmers lived in the same kinds of huts, farmed the same way, wore the same kinds of clothes, and spoke the same British language their ancestors had a century or more beforehand, while the cities were Latin-speaking industrial and economic centers on par with anywhere else in the Roman world outside of Rome itself. The economy, in essence, was founded on massive state expenditures in these cities and on the army. The army required an enormous movement of staple goods like food and equipment to support it, and large-scale trade in other bulk goods like pottery piggybacked off the state-run trade. Basically, until about 200, Britain had two parallel economies, a rural one run by local people and an urban one run by, for, and through the state. All of that changed in the course of the rough 3rd century. There were no more major military campaigns in Britain after around 200, and the size of the army was reduced by half, which meant much less in the way of imported goods. Trade in general dropped off through that century, and cities both in Britain and on the continent which had depended on that trade fell hard and fell fast. London, for example, had been a densely populated city in 200. By 300, 2/3 of the city's buildings had been dismantled. There was no longer a public bath, and nobody was using the forum. This was pretty typical for cities in Britain, but it doesn't mean that urbanism disappeared, or even that the economy had gone downhill. Instead, the province's economy reoriented itself around local production, rather than massive, state-driven imports and expenditure. Rather than importing huge amounts of goods, a regional market economy grew up. Big-time British producers of pottery and other goods sold their wares at small but prosperous towns throughout the country, places that sat at the intersections of rivers and roadways. For the first time, even poor rural farmers started using money to buy and sell mass-produced goods at these small-town markets. Rural aristocrats started to build big, Roman-style villas for themselves in the countryside. Cities were smaller, but they were still wealthy. These villa-owning aristocrats also built luxurious townhouses for themselves, and cities like London became places for the elite to see and be seen. Despite the wealth of these aristocrats, though, late Roman Britain was characterized by broad prosperity all across the social scale. The historian Robin Fleming summed things up this way in her book Britain After Rome, one of my absolute favorites. Quote, "The years 290 to 360 were the high point of Romanitas, Romanness, in Britain, and in many ways, these years represent the most Roman moment in British history. Roman culture, the Roman state, and Roman goods were all embraced or imposed to varying degrees, both in public and in small towns, in palatial villas and on peasant farmsteads. Most people had some access to the profusion of British-produced, Roman-style goods of the period, goods created in a Roman economy founded on mass production and dependent upon organized industries, networks of local markets, an abundance of low-value currency, and, of course, peace." She goes on to say, quote, "Indeed, it was as Roman in the 4th century as any other place on the planet."
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So what happened to Roman Britain? Three things. First, the economy collapsed. That might sound dramatic, but there's no other honest way to put it. Second, the political structures collapsed. Again, there's no other way to put it. The entire island fragmented into a patchwork of small kingdoms. Finally, the Anglo-Saxons arrived. Not everybody agrees on a doom and gloom picture of Britain in the 5th and 6th centuries, and I want to emphasize that change is not, in itself, some terrible thing. Change doesn't require a value judgment, and the end of Roman Britain produced winners as well as losers. Still, it's hard to argue that the average person's quality of life didn't drop drastically in this period. The collapse of the economy and the collapse of political structures are intimately connected. Why? Because the Roman state and the people who worked for it in Britain, both soldiers and bureaucrats, were what drove the monetary economy. The state collected taxes in cash and then paid those tax revenues out to its representatives, who then spent that money in the local economy. When the Roman state in Britain collapsed, it stopped both collecting tax revenues and paying that money out. In the absence of new currency issues coming in from the continent, the last coins found in any quantities date to the 390s and the first decade of the 5th century, there was a finite amount of coinage in circulation. This created a liquidity crisis, where the limited amount of gold and silver in circulation drastically rose in value. People with agricultural or industrial surpluses to sell, excess crops or pottery or what have you, could no longer exchange those goods for coinage. So within about 30 years or so, by 430, the monetary economy of Britain had collapsed completely. The segment of the economy that was directly or tangentially connected to the state probably formed about 20% of the total, and that just completely disappeared. This hit industrial production, things like pottery, metalworking, and the construction business, the hardest. Why? Because you paid for those things in coin, and they had to travel from the site of production to markets. Without money, and with disappearing markets, there was no incentive to produce them or cash to exchange for them. In essence, the entire consumer economy, the quintessentially Roman part of the economy, disappeared in a relative blink of an eye. Still, Britain's economy was mostly agrarian. Probably 80% or 90% of the population and productivity was in the agricultural sector, and these monetary shifts wouldn't necessarily have hit it too hard. People still had to eat, and as long as they still had to eat, they'd continue to grow crops, brew beer, and raise animals. Even with agriculture, though, there were some substantial changes in the 5th century. A lot of marginal land, like swamps, particularly rocky fields, or coastal land that required dikes to prevent flooding, fell out of cultivation. Pollen analyses tell us that formerly cleared fields reverted to forest, and that land that had been used to grow grain was instead used for grazing animals like sheep or cows. Per acre, growing crops is more productive than raising animals, so that shift toward raising animals probably speaks to a decrease in the demand for food. In other words, agriculture became generally less intensive, although this was more true in some places, like the north along Hadrian's Wall, than it was in the west of the country. Now, to be fair, we should entertain the possibility that things weren't necessarily as bad as they look in this analysis. The loss of the monetary economy is going to look really bad when we rely on archaeology, because things like metal objects, pottery, and coins are highly visible in the material record. When we go digging for things, that's what we expect to find. So things like wood, leather, and clothing, which are all real things that a functioning economy produces, just don't survive. They especially don't survive in an environment like Britain that's wet everywhere and has a lot of regions with acidic soils, which affect preservation. So is it possible that what we're seeing is just a giant hole in our evidence? That aside from that one chunk of the economy, everything was functioning more or less just fine? I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. First, because of the shifts in agriculture that I just mentioned. These weren't catastrophically bad changes, but there was less land under cultivation, and that cultivation was less intensive, which speaks to some serious underlying issues. It's probably a safe bet that it had something to do with a falling population. Second, even if the economy was at 10 or 15% industrial production and 85 or 90% agriculture, losing 10 or 15% of Britain's economy in just 20 or 30 years is still a huge deal. It's puzzling to me that a historian or an archaeologist could cite those figures with a straight face and say it's not that big of an issue, but that's where we are. Now third, the end of the monetary economy. Coinage was everywhere in 4th century Britain, and, as you do today, you used money to pay for things. Without overstating the obvious, money is a useful financial tool to have at your disposal. That's not just because it's useful for day-to-day transactions, but also because it enables long-distance trade, of which there was a great deal in 4th century Britain. If you don't have money, how are you going to pay for things like imported wine, or building materials, or pottery, or any of the other things that the inhabitants of Britain had grown used to having during the period of Roman rule? Now put all that together. Industrial production disappears, and so does trade. Not just the large quantities of bulk goods like food staples and ceramics, but even the small quantities of luxury items. Think about how many people in a complex economy like that of 4th century Britain worked directly or indirectly in those segments. You had iron workers and potters, sure, but you also had miners. You had builders, but you also had quarry workers. You had the porters and longshoremen who loaded and unloaded goods, and you had the merchants who transported those goods from where they were made to the markets where they were sold. Put together, you're talking about a huge number of people out of work, and a tremendous amount of wealth removed from the economy as a whole. All of this leads directly into the last point, the end of urbanism. Like the rest of the Roman Empire, Roman Britain was a province of towns, and especially cities. As I mentioned before, these cities were smaller and less populous than they'd been in the 1st and 2nd centuries, but they were still wealthy places, and they were still recognizably cities. By 500, these cities were completely gone. York, for example, had been a major urban center and an army base, but it reverted to completely uninhabited marshland. We know that because the remains of beetles, whose habitat is high grass and reeds, have been found in layers of debris from the early 5th century. Urbanism, as a phenomenon, was done and through. Even those small, prosperous market towns that I mentioned, the ones where mass-produced goods could be bought and sold, disappeared. Why? Because there were no more mass-produced goods to sell there. So this was the economic downfall of Britain. Now let's talk politics. In the 4th century, Britain was a Roman province. It had a Roman governor, Roman officials who collected taxes and performed administrative functions, and it had a substantial chunk of the Roman army manning forts, watchtowers, and military bases, even if that segment of the Roman army was smaller than it had been in the 1st and 2nd centuries. By the 6th century, Britain was a patchwork of small kingdoms. Some of them ruled by the native aristocracy, whether they spoke British or still spoke Latin, and some of them were ruled by English-speaking Anglo-Saxons. What happened? While 4th century Britain was Roman in every meaningful way, it wasn't devoid of problems, and the biggest of those problems were increasingly serious raids from beyond the borders. Those raids came from a number of different sources. The first group were the Picts, a Celtic-speaking tribal confederation, or series of tribes, living in today's Scotland to the north of Hadrian's Wall. The name comes from the Latin picti, meaning painted or tattooed, but we have no idea what they called themselves. The second group are the Scoti. Despite that confusing name, the Scoti, or Scots, were actually Irish. They came across the Irish Sea in ships to raid Britain and eventually settled all along the west coast of the island. That's why Scotland is called Scotland, and why Gaelic, which is a descendant of Old Irish, is spoken there. The third group is the most famous, the Saxons, who lived along the North Sea coast of the continent between today's Netherlands and Denmark. Why are they the most famous? Because their raids eventually turned into large-scale settlements, and then into political domination. Practically every textual source that talks about 4th century Britain mentions these raids, and contrary to what some historians would say about them, I don't see any real reason to disbelieve these sources. They tell us that on numerous occasions, Picts, Scoti, and Saxons formed raiding parties and ravaged particular areas of Britain both around Hadrian's Wall and in the south. Several times, Roman generals on the continent had to bring entire armies to Britain to deal with the threat. So why assume, as some historians and archaeologists do, that all of those sources are exaggerating or outright fabricating those events? Now conversely, there's no need to read every single piece of archaeological evidence through the lens of raiding and destruction. We don't have to look at a villa that burned in the first half of the 5th century near Hadrian's Wall and assume, well, the Picts must have done it. The place might have caught on fire and the owner decided it wasn't worth it to rebuild, or maybe, in the context of a disappearing monetary economy, he didn't have the money to do it. When we see the inhabitants of a town on the southeastern coast abandon it in the late 4th century, we don't have to assume that they left because of the threat of Saxon raiding. That's called overfitting the archaeological data to a narrative drawn from the texts, and it's a fundamentally misleading thing to do. So I want to suggest a middle ground here. Raiders, whether they came from Ireland, Scotland, or the North Sea coast of the continent, didn't have to burn cities or round up the entire population as captives to still have a serious negative effect on the quality of daily life, and there didn't have to be great marauding armies of them to do that. When you can't be sure whether your village will be safe from pillaging, when you can't be certain that you can leave home without threat of capture and being dragged away into slavery, like the St. Patrick who eventually converted the Irish, when a totally reasonable fear of banditry affects decisions that you make about taking a wagon or ship full of goods to trade, all of that matters. Fear of disorder and violence is just as powerful as the thing itself. When you pile up these incidents over decades and decades, you end up with a society that looks much different than one that wasn't particularly concerned about them. Let me put it like this. If you hear gunshots near your house at night and pick up shell casings in the street the next morning, you don't have to see the guys shooting firsthand to worry, reasonably, about what's going on in your neighborhood. Small bands of Picts, Scots, and Saxons operating with some regularity were more than sufficient to cause the kind of disruption that we see in the textual and archaeological record. Even if the Roman army was generally able to deal with them, the threat of incursion alone was enough to negatively affect the economy and the quality of daily life. All of this was happening while the Roman state was still operating relatively effectively in Britain, with an army that still kind of did its job and caught at least some of the Pictish, Scottish, or Saxon raiders. For a few decades, beginning around 340, the state clung to existence, but by the first decade of the 5th century, it was completely gone. A bunch of usurpers got their starts in Britain in these decades, Magnus Maximus and Constantine III being the most prominent of them, and they stripped the province of some of its last troops to go fight for them on the continent. These troops were never replaced, and the structures of civil government left with them as well. So if there's no longer a Roman state to collect taxes and surpluses, and there's no longer a Roman army to keep you safe, what happens politically? Let's take a minute and put ourselves in the shoes of a few different people in this situation and try to figure out how this all plays out. Now first, let's say you're a soldier. More specifically, you're an officer commanding a couple of garrisons along Hadrian's Wall. You were born here in Britain and joined the army as a young man, just like your father did before you, rising through the ranks through your hard work and talent. Constantine III, the usurper I just mentioned, departed for the continent in 408 AD with most of the troops and left you in charge of the few who remained in that section of the wall. Then you hear, a few years later, that Constantine was defeated and executed in southern Gaul. But nobody arrives from the new administration to take over. A few more years pass, and it becomes clear that you're on your own. By now, there's no pay coming, and in fact, you haven't been paid in coin for 10 years. There hasn't been a shipment of new weapons or armor in 15 years. The last time you saw an imported amphora of wine, you were a child. Your world is an increasingly local one, focused around the forts and the small towns that have grown up around them, not the cosmopolitan world of the Roman army your father served in. Your father was born in Britain, but he'd fought Franks on the continent before coming back. You, by contrast, have never left the island. Now you and your soldiers are still doing your jobs. You're hunting down the increasingly frequent raiding parties of Picts whenever you can, and local communities are still providing you with the food, beer, and other necessities they've been giving you for a couple of decades now. In fact, the local people are looking to you more and more for protection. 50 miles away, another garrison commander is doing the same thing you are. Most of the time you work together, but sometimes your troops fight each other too. So what are you now? Without the Roman state, you're not really a soldier. In fact, you start to look increasingly like a local warlord. Maybe you treat these local communities well. After all, there are raiders and they want safety, and you can provide that. But maybe you're running something that looks more like a protection racket, and your soldiers just take what they want. So this is one model. Now let's think about another, in the western part of Britain, like Wales. Rome's rule has never been all that strong here, and for most people, life has gone on for the last couple of centuries much like it did before the Romans ever showed up. Sure, there are some villas owned by rich, Romanized men, and there are towns that you might visit to buy some pottery, some iron tools, or even a luxury item. But in the countryside, everybody still speaks British, the farming practices are pretty much the same, and it's descendants of the old tribal chieftains who pretty much run things. Let's say you're one of these chieftains. You've dealt with the Romans and you speak Latin. Your father insisted that you learn to read it, too, so you might one day get a job in the Roman administration, like him. So you spent hours with an old Greek tutor reading Virgil and Cicero. But at heart, you still speak British, you hated learning Latin. You don't have much use for the few Roman officials you've met aside from your father, and you always thought of your father as more of a local leader than a Roman bureaucrat anyways. The army left your area, which is close to the Irish Sea, with Magnus Maximus in 383 AD, and it never came back. So now it's around 400. The Scoti raiding has picked up in intensity and violence. Some of them are even starting to put up permanent settlements along the coast. With no army, you have to defend yourselves, and as a person of local importance, you pick up the slack. You organize some of the farmers, the ones who had served in the army before Maximus left, or whose fathers had, into a militia, and you beat off a couple of Scoti raids. Turns out you're pretty good at fighting and organizing, so you start to collect taxes and pay some of these farmers to become semi-professional soldiers. You use more of that surplus you've collected to pay other folks to help you build a fort on top of a hill as a stronghold. Now, when the Scoti come to raid, you have a place where the people can flee. So what are you? You were the son of a Roman official, but now you're basically a warlord with a fort and a warband. Now finally, let's look at one more model. Let's say you're a rich aristocrat who lives in southeastern England, in what's now Kent near the mouth of the Thames River. You grew up in a luxurious villa with heat and indoor plumbing, and your family owned estates all over the region, along with a nice townhouse in Londinium in London. You and your family belong to the wealthiest elite of Romano-British society. But times are changing, even in this most Romanized part of Britain. The baths at your country villa break, and nobody knows how to fix them. A boatload of Saxons shows up and burns a village on one of your estates, carries off a bunch of people who were depending on you into slavery. The next year, there are 2 raids. The next year, there are 5 raids. There are only a few soldiers left manning the forts along the coast that are supposed to prevent this kind of thing, and they're not very good at their jobs. So now it's 410. Like most of these other rich aristocrats, you had a job in the Roman bureaucracy, collecting taxes from your fellow rich villa owners and the farmers who work on them. But there's nobody left to send those taxes to. So you, after collecting the taxes, keep them for yourself, and you think, okay, I'm going to do something about these raiders. You're not a military man, you know nothing about the army, but you get yourself a horse and armor and a sword, and you try to organize some of your dependent peasants into a militia, and you use that surplus to arm them. The next time the Saxons come, you're ready. You attack them after they've pillaged a village, weighed down by their plunder. But the Saxons are warriors, and you're not. It's not so much a battle as a slaughter. You try the next time the Saxons come, and this time, you and your band of militia manage to get them to drop their plunder as they head back to the boats. It's a small victory, but it makes you more confident. Now the next time they come, you manage to defeat them in a small pitched battle. All of a sudden, you're looking like the big man in the neighborhood. Sure, your villa's falling apart and you can't fix the broken baths or plumbing. There's nobody left who knows how to do that. But you still own a huge amount of productive, well-managed farmland. In the old days, you would have sold that surplus on the market and converted it to cash. But remember, there's no real functioning monetary economy anymore. You can, however, use that agricultural surplus from all that land you own to support your militia on a full-time basis. And like your counterparts along Hadrian's Wall or in the British-speaking part of Britain, you start to look like a local warlord. Now here's where it gets more complicated. 30 or 40 miles away, other big landowners have started doing the same thing. And maybe you guys get into a dispute over who owns a particular estate or village. Your little militia isn't enough to beat them, but you can use some of that agricultural surplus to hire a band of Saxons from the continent to help you out with your miniature war. So you pay the Saxons, and they help you defeat your local rival. In fact, you're doing so well that you add that territory to the land you already control, and your ambitions get bigger. You hire some more Saxons, who bring their families along with them, and all of a sudden, you've got an army on your hands. Maybe you even start to call yourself a king.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
These are three broad examples, but they represent narrative forms of what we see in the evidence, which is mostly archaeological. In the west of the country, old, abandoned hill forts from the pre-Roman period started to be refortified and reoccupied. In the north, the forts along Hadrian's Wall remained in use. In the southeast, burials of aristocrats show more of an emphasis on the military than the civilian. This is what political fragmentation looks like on the ground. Local strongmen from a few different backgrounds stepping up to fill the role that the Roman state had once occupied. There's good archaeological evidence to suggest increased violence after the 4th century, too. A large-scale survey of human remains suggests that an individual living in the 5th century east of England or in the north along Hadrian's Wall was 3 or 4 times more likely to have suffered trauma from a blade than someone living in late Roman Britain or in the west of the country at the same time. This was a more fragmented and more violent world than the one it replaced. So this brings us to the last major transformation of Roman Britain, the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons. In the traditional view, this population movement encompassed 3 distinct ethnic groups from the continent, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, each of which settled in a different region of England and which gave rise to a different early medieval kingdom or kingdoms. This clean, schematic view comes from the 8th century historian Bede, and it's way, way wrong. It's also from Bede that we get the idea of these Germanic-speaking migrants arriving first as mercenaries, which I mentioned a little while ago in the discussion of the rise of big men in the southeastern part of Britain. Unlike Bede's description of Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, though, this explanation is plausible enough, especially in conjunction with well-documented raiding activities, and the combination of raiding and mercenary work is similar to what we see elsewhere in post-Roman Europe. These Saxons might even have been first introduced and settled by imperial authorities, perhaps Magnus Maximus or Constantine III, in order to protect the coast when they headed for the continent to try their hand at usurping. However they first arrived, though, we know that these migrants stuck around and that many more followed them. So who were the Anglo-Saxons? Where did they come from? In what ways did they interact with the already existing population? How many migrants were there? Let's begin with the last question first. This is something that historians have spent a lot of time arguing about. We know that the material culture of Eastern Britain changed dramatically in the post-Roman period, and that it shares a lot of parallels with the North Sea coast of the continent. We know that Old English replaced Latin and British as the dominant spoken language in this part of Britain. But how many migrants did it take to effect these serious changes, to transform the heartland of Roman Britain into Germanic-speaking England? So for a long time, the assumption was one of mass migration. The incoming migrants from the North Sea coast killed or displaced the native inhabitants. This is what Gildas tells us, mostly. But the sheer logistics of this are staggering. There were a couple of million people living in this part of Britain. They weren't all killed or driven out. So a model called cultural diffusion replaced mass migration. The migrants simply took over the upper ranks of society in the eastern part of Britain. Because the dominant warrior aristocracy spoke English and dressed and built in a certain way, everyone else started to emulate them. Now the pendulum of opinion has swung back the other direction, though with some twists. Genetic evidence points to mass migration in this period. The male lineages present today in the east of Britain have more in common with the North Sea coast of the continent than they do with Western Britain. Still, genetics are a bit iffy as the sole source of evidence, for reasons that are really too kind of complex to go into here. Now, the evidence of isotopes from dental enamel from people buried in cemeteries in the 5th and 6th centuries directly points to large numbers of migrants from the continent. We don't have to infer a migration from genetic evidence. We can tell that these people were born in places that had a geological signature like that of the North Sea coast of the continent, which differed from that of the areas of Britain where they settled. This is direct evidence that these people moved. So how big did a migration have to be for it to be mass migration? Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people? I think tens of thousands would be enough to qualify. They didn't all come at the same time, or even from the same places along that North Sea coast. A few thousand migrants per year doesn't sound like many in the context of a region with a couple of million inhabitants, but over a century or so, that's a huge number. Remember that idea of cultural diffusion, too. If those immigrants disproportionately end up forming the dominant class in that society, they can reshape it dramatically. So where did these people come from, and who were they? Can we distinguish various groups from the continent in the archaeological record? The answer to that last question, not really. The migrants seem to have come from all along the North Sea coast, a region stretching roughly from today's Amsterdam in the Netherlands to the peninsula of Jutland, where Germany and Denmark meet. We know some names of ethnic groups, but to be frank, we don't know much about the internal distinctions within this Germanic-speaking world. Their languages were all similar, and so were their social structures. Their material cultures looked similar, too. It's likely that the idea of separate tribal origins, the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes that Bede talks about, only really became important in hindsight when these groups were trying to distinguish themselves from each other within England. So how should we understand this Anglo-Saxon migration? Here's my schematic view of this, influenced by a combination of modern migration theory drawn from sociology and anthropology, and my understanding of the archaeological evidence. So first, Germanic-speaking, seagoing people the Romans call Saxons raided Britain, just like the Saxons raided Gaul and even all the way down to Spain. The Romans and the native Britons feared them, fought them, and even named a part of the coastal defense, quote, the Saxon Shore. But they were just one more barbarian threat, along with the Scoti and the Picts. Second, some of these Saxons settled in Britain, almost certainly as mercenaries hired to fight the Picts and the Scoti around the end of the 4th century, beginning of the 5th century. They may have been invited by the local big men emerging in the absence of the Roman state, or they may have been settled by the imperial authorities, which happened all over the rest of the empire as well. Most likely possibility is a combination of the two. Some were settled by the imperial authorities, they got friendly with these emerging local warlords, and these early Saxon settlers acted as intermediaries with groups that were still back in the homeland on the continent. Now these early settlers, like most barbarians settled within the empire, were archaeologically invisible. They wore Roman armor, they used Roman weapons, they ate off Roman pottery, and they had Roman brooches pinning their cloaks. Now the third phase. The settled Saxons got some ideas about striking out on their own as political leaders. After all, they were soldiers, maybe they didn't much like working for haughty Romano-British landowners like the guy I talked about earlier. They still had some connections to the North Sea coast of the continent, so they brought in some more warriors to fight with them. Eventually, this trickle of fighting men became a flood, and they brought women and children with them. Others married local women. So it's at this point, a few decades later, around the 430s and the 440s, that a distinctly different material culture starts to show up in the east of Britain. Building practices changed. The migrants built sunken-floored huts and timber halls in place of the kinds of stone-built structures the Romano-British were constructing even at the same time. They wore different brooches to hold up their cloaks, brooches that had distinct parallels in what people were wearing along the North Sea coast. Most importantly, these new migrants buried their dead very differently than the native population. More migrants continued to arrive until the end of the century and even beyond. We know this from the isotopes and the human remains that we find in cemeteries. It was these migrants, not that initial wave of mercenaries or raiders, who transformed the material culture and linguistic map of Eastern Britain. So why did these people come? Some scholars have argued for climate change, that the North Sea coast was getting harder to effectively farm as sea levels rose and salt water inundated formerly productive land. This is a possibility, but that was happening in England, too. A more plausible explanation is political instability. As the Roman Empire collapsed, so too did its stabilizing effect on the barbarians who lived beyond its borders. The Saxon tribal confederation broke up, and this is precisely when we begin to see group names like Frisians, Angles, Jutes, what have you. This speaks to underlying political fragmentation, and that probably means that there was a group of people, like the Goths who entered the empire in the 370s, who were out there looking for new opportunities. These are what migration theorists call push factors, reasons why a migrant would want to leave his or her homeland. But why head to Britain? What were the pull factors that brought tens of thousands of continental migrants to an island that they'd never been to? Well, the fact that there were already Saxon settlers there was probably a big one. Migrants tend to go places where they will have a support network in place waiting for them. So let's imagine that you're a young Saxon warrior living in what's now the coast of Germany around 430. Your tribal chieftain has been killed in a battle against another petty Saxon king, and his rival would like to get rid of you and everyone else who was loyal to the old lord. Now, if you stay and fight, you're going to lose and you're going to die. But you have an uncle who migrated to Britain 10, 20 years before to work as a mercenary for one of those Roman aristocrats. You exchange messages because there are ships heading back and forth across the North Sea pretty regularly. Your uncle's prospering. There's plenty of work for young, talented warriors in Britain, it turns out. So you get a small ship, find another 10 warriors, a couple of families, and you set out across the North Sea, where you eventually land and meet up with your uncle in Britain. Now, once you're there, you do good work yourself. You marry a native woman, a relative of your uncle's wife. 5 or 10 years later, maybe some of your relatives follow you to Britain from the homeland. An existing support network, the possibility of a better life, rewarding work, those are all pull factors that would have brought Saxon migrants to Britain. Enough of these migrants came that they fundamentally transformed the eastern part of the island. And eventually, those migrants became politically powerful enough to found small kingdoms of their own, up and down the east coast of Britain, right alongside the local warlords we discussed earlier. As one final note, this world of the 5th century, this world of newly arrived Saxons and a fragmented political landscape, was also the world that produced the seeds that would one day grow into the legend of King Arthur, the mythical figure who ruled wisely with his Knights of the Round Table. Well, there was no such thing as a knight in the late 5th or early 6th century, and Arthur, if he existed, absolutely didn't rule the whole of Britain. If he existed is the key thing here. As I pointed out at the beginning of today's episode, our textual evidence is almost non-existent, and the first reference to Arthur doesn't occur until the 9th century. He's already a mythical figure then. Now, that doesn't mean that Arthur didn't exist. There are good arguments to be made in favor of his existence, and absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. There were Romano-British figures who fought the Saxons and each other, and it's perfectly plausible that there was one named Arthur in there. The figure with whom Arthur is most often identified is named Ambrosius Aurelianus, and he's only ever mentioned in Gildas' ranting sermon on the destruction of Britain. According to Gildas, this Ambrosius rallied the few British survivors of the Saxon onslaught and inflicted a stinging defeat on the Saxons at a place called Badon Hill. That's all we know about him. That's it. It doesn't make him a great king, doesn't mean he drove the Saxons back into the sea. Archaeologically, there's no sharp break in the late 5th century when Ambrosius Aurelianus won his victory. That's it. From those seeds eventually springs the legend of King Arthur in histories, poetry, and eventually romances in Welsh, French, and English. If there was ever a real King Arthur, this fragmented and confused world was his home. So let's sum up. By the long time frames we've been working with in this course, the fall of Roman Britain happened pretty quickly, mostly between 340 and 420 or so. I'm going to read another quote from Robin Fleming because it perfectly sums up how the world had changed by the early decades of the 5th century. Quote, "In the year 420, there were still people in Britain who had been born in a world shaped by the structures of empire, people whose early lives had been ordered by Rome's material culture, men and women whose universe had been given meaning by the shared assumptions of antiquity. There were tens of thousands left in 420 who had come of age playing in dusty, small-town streets, whose childhood dinners were served on pewter and glass, who had stood by the graves of grandparents and baby brothers dug in the great municipal cemeteries edging every town. There were middle-aged men who had been raised in heated villas. There were grandmothers whose fathers had paid taxes and whose mothers had bought cooking pots at local markets. But, although there were Romanized Britons, by 420, there was no longer a Roman Britain in which to live." That's just about perfect. By the beginning of the 6th century, a mere 90 years after the last would-be emperor left Britain for the continent with an army, the island was a patchwork of states. Some of them were ruled by British-speaking tribal chieftains who lived in refurbished Iron Age hill forts. In other areas, the descendants of Roman aristocrats, men like Ambrosius Aurelianus, ruled parts of the lowlands from ruined villas. Saxon migrants and their descendants held sway over still other areas. No matter where you were, though, things had changed dramatically. There was no monetary economy. There were no cities. There was very little long-distance trade. Not a single building was constructed with mortar, and nobody was making pottery. People dressed differently. As far as we know, nobody was really speaking Latin anymore. Either they'd referred it to British, or, in the East, people were starting to speak English like their Saxon overlords. Roman Britain and its complex economy and culture had been oriented south, toward the Mediterranean. Post-Roman Britain, and the Anglo-Saxon England that followed it, was oriented east and north, across the North Sea, both culturally and economically. This was the world of Beowulf. It was a simpler world, and a more local one. It was more dangerous, as the evidence of all those skeletons with blade wounds shows. Nowhere in the Roman Empire went down faster or harder than Britain. If you're looking for decline and fall, a real, genuine example of things getting worse and not just transforming into something new, Britain is where you'll find it. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. I'll be posting bibliographies for this and future episodes for anyone who's interested in going deeper into the material, so keep an eye out for that. Now, if you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. Until next time, thanks very much for listening.